Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Those were wolves howling together in Eureka, Missouri, at the Endangered Wolf Center. The center's pack includes several Mexican gray wolves. There are fewer than 300 Mexican gray wolves in the wild. They were hunted down to near extinction, and it has taken decades and a lot of human help for the population to reach this point. But last month, that small number of wild wolves got a few new voices to add to their howl. Six tiny wolf pups born at the Endangered Wolf Center. At just 10 days old, the six pups couldn't even open their eyes. When they did, they were somewhere in the wilds of New Mexico with a new family of wolves just like them. This isn't the first time Missouri-born wolves had made this journey. And joining me in studio to talk about it is Sarah Holliday, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at the Endangered Wolf Center. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
And we also have Susan Schmoker, the Endangered Wolf Center's curator. Welcome to you as well.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And thank you for joining today's show. So let's start with a bit of an introduction to Mexican gray wolves. Why are we bringing them back, Sarah?
Mexican gray wolves are the most genetically distinct subspecies of gray wolf. They're a little smaller than your typical gray wolf, but they, like you mentioned earlier, were declared extinct in the wild back in the 70s. And since then, the only reason why they're present out in the wild is because of an intensive breeding program. And the Endangered Wolf Center has been a part of that from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. What was that hunting for? Why was that happening?
There was a theory that if we got rid of all of the apex predators, that there would be more opportunity to hunt big game like elk and deer. And now that we know a little bit more about how ecosystems function, we mm-hmm. understand that that's not actually accurate.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Mexican wolf is not a species that is native to Missouri, but the fact that these wolves are making a comeback has a lot to do with a very specific wolf named Anna. She was born here at the Endangered Wolf Center in 2001, that is. What is it that led to Anna's, you know, being born here?
Anna is very lucky that the Endangered Wolf Center was founded within St. Louis, and she is honestly maybe the most famous Mexican wolf in history. She contributed greatly to the wild population. She had over 40 pups in her lifetime, some of which went out into the wild, and then some of her descendants are still here today.
Mm-hmm. We'd like to invite you to this conversation. What questions do you have about restoring the wolf population in this center in Missouri and elsewhere in the country? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpr.org. So fostering is something I think that people are familiar with when it comes to domesticated animals. You take a cat or a dog into your home for a brief period of time, and then you help them get more comfortable with people. But Susan, that is not what is happening here. These pups were barely born, and then they're getting flung, so to speak, into the wild. So what does fostering mean in this context?
So with our fostering program, we have moms at the center who are having their puppies. And then in the first 2 weeks of their life, we coordinate with Fish and Wildlife to locate wild dens. And then we get those puppies on a plane and we fly them out to those dens and slip them in with those wild moms. Mm-hmm. They have very strong maternal instincts. And generally when they end up in there, they're very quick to accept those puppies into their own den and to raise them as their own and teach them wild wolf behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And so where specifically does that fostering process begin?
So Within that first 2 weeks of their lives, you know, at the center, we do tend to be very hands-off. We don't want these animals to be disturbed by people, but we do a lot of observation in those first 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So first we are, and actually even before that, we have to watch mom to see, you know, if she might be pregnant. So we're observing her on camera and looking for behaviors that might indicate she is. One of those is selecting a den. So we have cameras in all of our dens. And we'll watch for things like digging, even decorating. We had a wolf that brought lots of rocks in. She thought they were very feng shui. So she made a little pile and decided that's what she wanted. We brought some dirt into another one, thinking that maybe we could help her out, give her some room to burrow. And mm-hmm. she removed all of it because she was not a fan.
Okay.
Beyond that, we are watching for them to give birth so we can count those babies. And then within that first 2 weeks, go in, get them, mm-hmm. pop them on a plane, get them out there. Mm-hmm.
Is the monitoring process itself something that is difficult? I mean, you mentioned cameras. Are there other ways that you are keeping track of them?
Yeah. So in that first period, we're trying to see if, you know, pregnancy even is something that's viable. We do have volunteers that go out to do observations. We set up a blind so the animals don't know that we're there, and we sit for about 4 hours at a time and just watch wolves, and we're looking for breeding behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Once we have seen that, it kind of tells us, you know, this is the start of our timeline. We know that from that point, you know, we might see puppies a couple, you know, a month later, 2 months later. Something around there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's
okay. We'll kind of be watching that. But in on those den cameras, every morning we come in and we review all of that footage from the night before and are looking for panting from mom, you know, and watching for her to be, you know, cleaning those babies off, nursing those babies, protecting them. We can usually see them climbing all over her, too.
Oh,
it gets
okay.
very difficult to determine how many are in there because they're very wiggly
mm-hmm.
And they're going all over the place and kind of really tucking up next to mom and getting into her hair and that fluffy fur to stay warm.
Right. Sarah, I saw photos of these tiny wolf pups. They are so adorable. It made me think of those Ann Getty's pictures of like babies lined up dressed as, you know, fruit or whatever. But these these pups were actually a lot cuter from my perspective anyway. They have dark colored fur and it looks like they're all sleeping. But it's because they're not ready to open their eyes yet, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So how is it that you can send these pups into the wild? Are they ready for that?
Well, that's actually the perfect age. They're very tiny. They're about the size of a potato. Their ears and eyes are both closed. And that at that age, they're entirely dependent upon mom. They can't see who mom is. They have very limited senses. And so when you're at that neonate development stage, we can pull them from that litter and put them into a new litter in the wild. And then they don't know that they were moved. They
mm-hmm.
have no awareness of that. And so they get to experience a wild life and learn from parents who are thriving
mm-hmm.
out in the wild.
Yeah. So May 5th is when these pups, this lupine six-pack, got put on a plane. And each of you had some part of that. What was that day like? Who wants to start?
I can take that one.
Sure, Susan.
So it starts very early. We were up at 2 in the morning. It's very dark. You go out into this wooded area. Our site is located far away from people, so it is pitch black. On the day that my first foster, it was raining, and all you can see is, you know, what you can see by the light of these headlamps that everyone's wearing. And usually the wolves start howling, so it's just dark and rainy, and you're surrounded by howling wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like it would be kind of scary. I described, I think, you know, a scene in a horror film, but it's not. It actually is really beautiful, and I think it's because you can really feel that, you know, there's less than 300 of them left. Each one of them really matters, and while you're standing there in the dark listening to their voices, you realize you're holding something very special. It's a full circle moment where you can feel the impact of your actions and also of all the collaboration that's required to save the species.
Mm-hmm. And you've now been doing this work at the Endangered Wolf Center for about a year, right?
Just a year, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, based on what you've experienced before, how does what you saw and felt on May 5th compare?
It's different, but it's connected. Mm-hmm. So before I was at the center, I worked with a lot of different kinds of wildlife. I actually started with birds of prey. I started with raptors, which is not where I thought I would be. And I fell in love with a turkey vulture. Yeah. His name was Sir Pigeonus, which was a joke that the vet made. Sir Pigeonus, well, we called him Sir P because he was clearly a very noble bird.
Okay.
It's a term that describes a wound or something like a lesion.
Okay.
And that was because turkey vultures are generally, you know, associated with death and disease. They bite, they hiss, they poop on things they don't like, they throw up on things they don't like. But for me, that experience was really pivotal because, you know, I realized that bird was so much more than that. Mm-hmm. I got to know him and I spent time learning about him. I realized he was actually very sensitive. He had favorite food. It was generally the fresh stuff.
Okay.
He liked sunning. He just was so much more than I thought he was. And that to me is kind of like, you know, how I see the wolves and how I experience a lot of animals that have unfair reputations.
Mm-hmm.
I made a lot of assumptions about him, but he taught me to be really curious and to be open-minded, which I've also carried, you know, into just life in general. I have learned that I can gain a lot of perspective by listening to other people share theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And it, yeah, it's what brought me to the center and brought me to wolves.
Yeah. Sarah, for you, you've been there now 10 years. I would imagine you've seen pups, you know, fly.
Yes.
What was it like for you to see this group of pups leave?
This foster was special to me. Their dad is the only Mexican wolf living that was born using artificial insemination with frozen thawed semen. And so that experience and that full circle for him to be able to be alive and contributing to his population and to the wild population through his offspring, mm-hmm. and letting that generation grow up and then hopefully seeing them next year have their own packs. That's why I'm here. I mean, this is one of the most fulfilling experiences that we have every year.
Yeah. Were you on the plane?
I was.
Oh, okay. What was that like?
It's always an amazing experience. We partner with a nonprofit that provides planes for conservation reasons.
Oh.
And so we're able to get a private flight, which helps us get those pups out there super quick.
Mm-hmm.
But we're constantly on the flight monitoring those puppies, making sure the temperature is right, making sure they're looking good, just like mom would have in the den. And then usually at some point we are making sure they're fed at least once so that they have full bellies and they're prepared to go into those dens.
Mm-hmm. So were they dozing most of the time?
Yes. This is a sleep eat stage for them.
So there was no reaction to being that high in the air?
No, they'll sometimes spread out a little bit if they get warm, or huddle together if they're a little cold. Sometimes the personalities come out where one might be a little bit more interactive or you might hear vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, they seem at peace. They're sleeping and full bellies and comfortable.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Support comes from Parrot Corporation, a contractor with over four decades of shaping the St. Louis landscape. More at parrot.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about efforts to restore the populations of endangered wolves and a recent trip made by six tiny wolf pups from Missouri to New Mexico. I'm joined by Sarah Holliday, Director of Animal Care and Conservation at the Endangered Wolf Center in Eureka, and the center's curator, Susan Schmoker. So, Sarah, Missouri did have a population of red wolves at one point, and according to the Missouri Department of Conservation, the last red wolf, Missouri red wolf, was killed in 1950. How is it that we got to that point?
It's a very similar story to the Mexican wolf story as well. Again, hunters wanted to ensure they had a lot of game, elk, deer, etc., and they thought the way to do that was to get rid of those apex predators. And red wolves were no exception to that. Mm-hmm. And so their numbers were drastically decreasing, and they were at one point also declared extinct in the wild. And now, today, there are less than 20 in North Carolina.
Less than 20.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Susan, your focus is on wolves who do live here in Missouri. And I understand that that involves a lot of monitoring. We got some of that from what you were talking about, you know, watching the wolves. And then when it comes to breeding, there's very precise timing involved. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
So that breeding season starts roughly around January, February. And what we start to see and hear a lot of is a lot of howling. they communicate with those howls. They communicate long distance with each other that way. You know, they're letting each other know who's here, who's boss, all of those things. We don't want to get too close to our habitats because we are trying to keep our presence limited. So we do use those trail cams to observe. And then anytime we do go anywhere near those habitats, we can kind of see them off in the distance. They do tend to kind of hang out away from us. And we set up those blinds. And it is very cold when you're sitting there. There's often a lot of snow on the ground. Your toes go numb.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll be looking for different behaviors from them. You have to really understand canid behavior in a lot of ways because, you know, I think tails are probably the one that I feel like people misinterpret a lot, that just as an example.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, when people see a wagging tail, they think, you know, happy dog. And for a wolf, it is kind of a dominance display,
mm-hmm.
But also maybe an excitement display. So kind of depending on all of the things that we're seeing, we can tell, you know, if this is going to be leading to some good, positive, reproductive behavior that we want to see,
mm-hmm.
especially if the male is doing it towards the female and indicating that he's interested. She might deflect her tail to indicate that she's interested. So we do a lot of that. It is a lot of work because on top of that, we are still taking care of all of the other canids that we have at the center. So we do involve volunteers and have them come and help us, which is really cool, you know,
mm-hmm.
to see the community getting involved. And for me, you know, it's one of those a marker of success, you know, for me, for lack of a better word, just
mm-hmm.
because we can't do this without support, you know,
yeah.
from other people, without people caring about the wolves the way that we care about the wolves. And when you have someone who's willing to give up their time and come and sit in the cold for 4 hours.
Right, right.
And, you know, you can't have coffee with you. You can't have tea with you. Anything they can smell, because we don't want them to know we're there.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, warm beverages, unless it's just hot water, which is very boring.
Oh, right.
You can't have an iPod with you. So, you know, we need you focusing on the wolves. Can't be playing on your phone. You can't have anything that makes noise. You know, you are just completely focused on them in that time.
Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of commitment then.
It really does.
So the fostering in the wild, this is something that has been going on for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put in perspective, Susan, what impact that has on the packs? Mm.
Yeah, so the Endangered Wolf Center was founded in the 70s by Marlin and Carol Perkins. If those names are familiar, it's because Marlin was one of the hosts of Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
Yes.
but they started that because they, specifically with wolves, were seeing a decline in those canid populations. When the project began, there were seven founders that have now contributed to the entirety of both the wild population and the managed population under human care.
Mm-hmm.
Which is incredible. You know, we went from seven to somewhere between, you know, 200 and 300 wolves. So what we're doing matters quite a bit because we have to you know, manage that diversity and make sure that those genes are nice and diverse. That's how these puppies actually are contributing to that wild population. And of course, the ones that remain behind are the ones that continue, like Anna's progeny, to contribute to the ones that are still under human care.
Yeah. And on that note about contributions, we have Jay, who is calling from Normandy. Jay, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Yeah, thank you both. I really love wolves. I hear what you can do to help them that way. How about organizations like Defenders of Wildlife? Do they help the wolf population like they say they do? I hope they do. Mm-hmm. And because I contribute to them.
Yeah.
And also, how about a comparison with your family dog's intelligence? Can you get we think we've got a pretty smart Australian Shepherd, but I'd be curious to know how they match up. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Jay. So, Sarah, is there something you'd like to address in Jay's questions?
Yeah, I would love to. There are so many collaborators to help the Mexican wolf species become successful out in the wild. Defenders of Wildlife is a nonprofit that advocates for that species and is a partner in many ways. So we couldn't do it without everybody involved. There are at least 60 institutions that help with breeding and care for these animals in human care, not including all those other nonprofits that help.
Mm-hmm. Jay also said something about his Australian shepherd, I think.
Yeah.
Smart dogs.
Yes.
And wolves also are smart. I mean, is there something about that that comes into play? I mean, the wolf pups who left about a month ago have made their trip to New Mexico. Is that natural intelligence part of what makes it possible for them to survive in the wild even when they're so young?
Yeah, so I love this this connection that we're making. So wolves are very intelligent animals. Part of why the puppies benefit from being with those wild moms is because they're sharing that intelligence. They know where all the water sources are. They know where the food is. They know how to catch the food. And they're going to teach that to all of those babies, right? And what I really love about this connection is that I think we're very quick to love dogs, right? Mm-hmm. And very quick to be a little critical of wolves.
Yeah, right,
And that's largely because of how we've created a narrative around wolves that makes them seem very scary and like they have lots of negative traits.
Mm-hmm.
I remember growing up listening to stories like Peter and the Wolf,
right,
or The Three Little Pigs, watching Beauty and the Beast. There's modern movies like The Gray and tons of idioms like A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing that, you know, depict someone who is shady or predatory in behavior. But in reality, wolves have so many characteristics that we really admire, like loyalty and intelligence and family connection and perseverance. All things that we admire in dogs and all things they share.
Right, right. Sarah, for you, having come to this region specifically to work at the Endangered Wolf Center, what is it that you have learned in the past 10 years about what this all entails?
I think the biggest aspect of this for me is how many different organizations across the country and even binationally, because this is a program that involves Mexico as well, all collaborate. They put their pride aside and opinions aside, and they come to the table with the same goal of helping this species.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I have taken out of this, that you cannot conserve a species without collaboration.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller from St. Louis. Elena, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead.
I just wanted to, in case a lot of people listening weren't aware about the summer camp program that they also have going on right now at the Endangered Wolf Sanctuary. My daughter just finished camp last week, and she really loved it. She's 9 years old, and they had campers from, I would say, probably 7 up to maybe 14 that did a wonderful kind of immersive day camp at the wolf sanctuary, and they got to see all the different species of canids, which is right up my daughter's alley. She geeked out all week and had a lot of fun. So kudos to the sanctuary for providing that camp. And I don't know if there's still spots, but it was reasonable. It was a great educational experience. Even with our tornado drill going on, like a real life tornado warning, we felt she was very safe there and in capable hands with the camp director and all the other staff. So we're big fans already, and we want to bring a big group. So maybe, I don't know if you spoke on that already, but if once you're done giving us all an education, all these wonderful animals, if you can speak a little more about how people can come and visit and how the tours work. And I understand they also maybe do birthday parties and things just to kind of get the word out there even more about this wonderful place.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Elena, for all of that. Yes, Sarah.
Thank you so much. It is so heartening to hear that the next generation is enjoying the Endangered Wolf Center and our legacy is being passed on. We get to see camp once a week because our keepers get to chat with them. And it's always an amazing experience to hear what they have to say, what questions they have, and to help them get excited about all the canids that we have.
Mm-hmm.
We do offer a variety of programs. So we have public tours every day except Tuesday. And then we do private tours. Evening howls are one of our major programs as well, mm-hmm. where you get to hear the wolves howl. And then we have birthday parties and outreaches and field trips too.
Mm-hmm. And as we close here, let's do a bit of an update about red wolves. Last year, St. Louis Public Radio reported on the birth of 5 red wolf pups here. And Fred Gauna, who's the executive director of the Endangered Wolf Center, said at the time that the births are crucial to maintaining a healthy population. And he said the center would keep a hands-off approach with the wolf pups. What can you tell us about how they're doing now, a year later?
Yeah, so they're about a year old. They're a little bit bigger than they were last year, but they're still with mom and dad. They learn so much from their parents and from older siblings, so they need that time spent with them to understand how to be a wolf. Mm-hmm. But they're doing great. They're in a very secluded habitat on one of our hillsides, just enjoying life. And I hope that in a couple of years, they might have the opportunity to be released into the wild.
Mm-hmm. The final question here. Does your devotion to wolves extend to like a tattoo, maybe to one of our colleagues actually has a wolf tattoo? Oh, Sarah.
Yes, actually, that's a very good question for me. I do have a red wolf paw tattooed on the top of my foot, mm-hmm. and it is a wolf that my family got to name.
Oh.
And so it is very special to me,
okay.
and it helps remind me of why I'm here and what my purpose is in my life.
Yeah. Well, that's lovely. And not a requirement for those wanting to volunteer.
No, not at all.
Sarah Holliday is the Director of Animal Care and Conservation at the Endangered Wolf Center, and Susan Schmoker is the Endangered Wolf Center's curator. Susan and Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.